This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. President Donald Trump landed at Southwest Florida International Airport this morning shortly before 11 o'clock. The president announced he'd be making the trip to Southwest Florida along with First Lady Melania Trump and Vice President Mike Pence on Twitter earlier this week to survey the damage left in the wake of Hurricane Irma. NPR Southern Bureau Chief Russell Lewis is live in Naples. Russell, what are the president and vice president seeing today?
Well, they're seeing, you know, with the power of what a Category 3 and 4 hurricane like Hurricane Irma can do. They made a helicopter ride from Fort Myers down to Naples and were able to fly low and look at all of the destruction from the hurricane and from the twisters that came from the hurricane. They made a pit stop at a mobile home park called Naples Estates, and that's where they got out, spent about 20 minutes or so. Talking to residents of this hard-hit mobile home park, they also were at a food line and serving out food to people there. And by all accounts, everyone here loved the fact by having them here, felt like the federal government was paying attention, and they basically just were very happy to see the president.
You know, Collier County is among some of the hardest-hit areas of Florida, especially areas like Everglades City and Marco Island. I understand that the president flew to Naples in that helicopter. Did you get any sense that he was able to see any of these other more outlying areas like Immokalee, Everglades, and Marco?
Yeah, I actually don't know the route of travel that they're going to take, nor, you know, the route that they're going to take when they're leaving to fly back up to Fort Myers. They may swing down south and back out east a little bit to sort of see it. So, you know, it's clear that no matter where you look at the moment, though, you see a tremendous amount of destruction from this hurricane, a tremendous amount of rebuilding that needs to be done, and a lot of heartache. But at the same time, you also see smiles from people knowing that, you know, they're alive, they can get through this, they see FEMA here, they see insurance adjusters, they know that it's, you know, every day you have to sort of take it one day at a time to be able to sort of, you know, piece your lives back together.
I know you mentioned earlier that people seemed pretty happy that the federal government in the form of President Trump was there paying attention to them today. Did you see much in the way of turnout? You know, Collier County and Southwest Florida went for Trump in 2016. Are people going out of their way to see him today, or are they too busy with cleanup?
No, I would say, I would say most people are cleaning up. There were probably, I'd say about 2 or 3 dozen people that lined up right outside of the mobile home park waiting for the president. They did it, you know, an hour in advance, waiting, sweating in the hot sun, of course, in the humidity. And, you know, there were people there holding signs saying, welcome, Mr. President, welcome, Ms. First Lady. There were a lot of people that were excited to see the president. Lots of cheers and absolutely no jeers whatsoever. And the sense that I got from people really was is that they were just happy to see the president was here. The only negative that I heard was I was talking to a resident who lived across the street from this mobile home park. Their condominium complex was also heavily damaged. Also, like this one, is without power. And they were a little bit disappointed that the president wasn't going to cross the street so that they could talk to them to show them, you know, sort of the damage and the difficulties that they're going through at the moment.
So I know you're from the area. You're familiar with this area, at least. What are you seeing in Naples today? Are you surprised by what you're seeing?
Yeah, you know, I used to live in Naples, actually, and, you know, driving down the interstate and getting off and driving around just a little bit, I was struck by the level of destruction that is here. I went through Hurricane Wilma back in 2005. I was on the air for WGCU when that storm came ashore. And, you know, the damage that you see here is certainly more than that. And it's, you know, it's sad if you think about it. You know, I'm sitting here looking in this mobile home park, and I'm looking at people's lives that have just been, you know, basically turned upside down with roofs ripped off. I talked to one guy who said that, you know, his mobile home was completely destroyed. He's happy that he's alive. He's happy that, you know, his wife made it through. But for him, he's just sort of sad that it happened. He says that he's planning to rebuild, but not rebuild here. He is going to move somewhere else in Naples. And, you know, just what you see here is just sort of the level of destruction from this powerful hurricane.
It's pretty surprising when you actually see it face to face. So what else is on the president's agenda today? Is he headed back to D.C.?
Yeah, so he's on his way back to Washington today. He's got some meetings and the like. I'm not sure with the vice president how much longer he's going to be sticking around. So this was just a quick trip for the president. You know, this is what presidents do in this time. You know, they call them the consoler-in-chief. You basically, you show up, you hug people, you shake their hands, you just sort of, you know, tap them on the shoulder, let them know that you're here, that you're paying attention, that you understand what they're going through, and that the federal government is here to help. It's a long history of presidents doing this, and, you know, it's something that presidents just need to do as part of their job.
All right. Thanks so much. Russell Lewis with the NPR. Thanks for being part of our show today.
You're welcome. It's good to be back on Gulf Coast Live once again.
The president is surveying damage done to our region from Hurricane Irma, and just how bad that damage has been can be seen by stress on the water supplies across southwest Florida counties. A boil water notice remains in place for all customers of Collier County Public Utilities. That means allowing all water used for drinking and cooking to come to a rolling boil for at least 1 minute. Today, Collier County officials in a release are stressing that the county's lift stations are flooding. Those are the stations that move wastewater out of the system. They're advising residents to minimize their water use, as using too much water while the lift stations are not fully restored can risk sewage backups into your home. Some examples of how you can help is to not do your laundry, use your dishwasher less often, try to minimize flushing of the toilet, and take very short showers. North in Englewood, the water district in Charlotte County says that water service has been restored to Minnesota Key, but a precautionary boil water notice remains in effect there. Residents, again, should boil water used for drinking and cooking purposes. The district is also asking residents to conserve water there for the same reasons. Turning now to updates on curfews. First in Lee County, the city of Fort Myers has lifted its overnight curfew, but Fort Myers Police Chief Derek Diggs is asking residents to continue to minimize travel, especially after dark. Currently, Bonita Springs, Estero, and Lehigh Acres are the only areas in Lee County where the post-hurricane curfew remains in effect. Curfews last from between 8 p.m. and 7 a.m. Then in Charlotte County, Sheriff Bill Prummel has ended the countywide curfew. The county's ban on alcohol sales was also lifted yesterday, and Clewiston has also lifted its overnight curfew for that city. Curfews are still in effect in Collier County. It's still under mandatory countywide curfew between the hours of 9 p.m. and 6 a.m. And according to the Hendry County Sheriff's Office, the countywide curfew remains in effect for the city of LaBelle and in unincorporated areas of the county from 7 p.m. until 7 a.m. daily. Now to the question on many minds, now 4 days after Hurricane Irma made landfall in our region, when will those lights be back on? Crews with Florida Power and Light are continuing efforts to restore power throughout the state. More than 4.4 million customers lost power during the hurricane, and as of today, more than 3 million homes have seen power restored, but still about 1.3 million remain without power. First, a quick update from Lee County Electrical Cooperative, though. As of this morning, 61% of its nearly 215,000 customers in the region have had power restored. Still, 39% of customers remain without power, including homes on Marco Island, Immokalee, Everglades City, Lehigh Acres, North Fort Myers, Cape Coral, Pine Island, and Sanibel. But for most of us, when we think about electricity, we think of Florida Power and Light. Joining us now for an update on restoration efforts is FPL spokesperson Bill Orlov. Bill, when can people in Southwest Florida expect to have power fully restored?
Well, first of all, I want to let everyone know that we're working round the clock to get all of our customers restored. In Southwest, that time will be by the 22nd. We know that we'll get most of those customers on back before then, but this storm did some damage to our grid in some hard-hit areas where there was either tornadic activity or some kind of flooding. You know, it is going to take us some time to get to those customers, but I want everyone to know that we're working 24/7 with a crew of more than 20,000 that are dedicated to getting the lights back on for our customers safely and as quickly as possible.
It's like an army out there that you have amassed, but I wanted to ask, there are some people that may not have power, but they see that power is on maybe a block or two away. Do they need to be concerned that they've been forgotten, or is there a way for you to know exactly who has and has not got power?
Yeah, we know where all of the outages are, and we are laser focused on getting the power back on to all of those customers who are still without power. Because customers may see in a certain area where lights are on, but theirs are not, it's because there may be a piece of equipment, a line that needs to be fixed. So they are working diligently round the clock to get everyone back online.
I know that you said that September 22nd is the date that you plan or that you anticipate everyone having their power back on. I think a lot of people are hopeful that you're saying the 22nd so that you have extra time, that you think they're going to get things done before the 22nd. Have you had anything that's pushed you back beyond what your projected deadlines were?
Well, this was a ferocious storm that made landfall, unfortunately, on your coast and had hurricane-force winds that did damage not only to the trees that come into the lines, but to some of the grid. And this is going to cause us to rebuild some of those areas, not just restore power within a couple of days, but we need to fix parts of the grid, and that takes time. And we certainly appreciate and ask for our customers' patience as we work through this, and we will all get through it together with some patience and keeping safety top of mind.
I wanted to ask about specifically Marco Island and Everglades City. Those were, and also Immokalee, those are three areas actually that were really hard hit down here. Are they kind of looking more towards the 22nd, a little bit of later than the rest, or is there any, it's kind of a micro projection as far as how quickly they'll be getting power back? But I know that those were some hard hit areas and they could use some power tools down there.
Yeah, I'm not able to go into that specific level into certain cities or neighborhoods. I can only speak at the county level at this point. As the restoration process proceeds, I might be able to give more information. But we are working around the clock to get everyone back on. And if those areas are hardest hit, like I said, if it was due to the hurricane force winds, flooding, any damage to our system, that will take some time to rebuild. That.
So you mentioned a little bit that you have a county by county thing, and I was noticing, I was reporting on it yesterday, and since yesterday things have improved quite a bit just overnight. Can you tell me a breakdown of the counties like Hendry, Collier, Lee? How are they looking as far as percent of people that are out of power and that have it back?
Sure. So as you know, we're not the sole provider in those counties, but I can give you the numbers for FPL, and I'll go down the list alphabetically. For Collier County, right now we have 125,860 customers that are without power out of 210,000 that we serve. In Hendry County, we have 6,280 customers that are out of total of 9,700. And in Lee County, that number is 130,000 customers, a little more than 130,000 customers out of 259,900 served. So we do have a ways to go. We are making headway, but every day, every hour, we are picking up more customers, and we just ask our customers to be patient as we continue to work through this.
So, you know, I'm really focused here on Southwest Florida. What are you dealing with throughout the rest of the state?
Well, we're finding similar issues in that we're seeing that our transmission lines held up very well. These are the poles and wires that you see that are providing high voltage energy. You mostly see them on highways and major streets. Those held up very well. Some of our neighborhood lines, ones that are shorter, those receive damage not from wind, but from trees coming into it, bringing down not only power lines, but some of our equipment and our poles as well. And it takes time to put in that infrastructure back in place. So it's easier to reset a power line than it is to reset poles and put in new equipment. So that's what's really taking the most time during this restoration.
And tell me a little bit about the size of this restoration effort from Florida Power and Light. You have people coming from all over. How far away are people coming from, and how many do you have working on it?
Well, we have a restoration force of more than 20,000. They come from 30 states throughout the country and as far north as Canada. We do have crews from Illinois, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and as far west as California. And as we help other energy companies when they have severe weather, when they have massive outages, and they need our help, we respond, and we certainly appreciate all the response that we've received throughout the country and Canada to help us and our Floridians in their time of need.
Well, I know that they should probably be wearing hero capes. I know that there are some people that have mentioned through social media that they've been feeding people that are putting their power back on in their neighborhoods. So definitely the effort is much appreciated.
Well, I can tell you a little nice story that actually happened last night on the East Coast in Palm Beach County. A girl was celebrating her 11th birthday, and she asked her father what she wanted, or her father asked what she wanted, and she said, "I just want to bring an icy truck to the South Florida Fairgrounds in West Palm Beach to give some relief to the crews that are working throughout the day and night." And it was really a wonderful treat to our crews. They certainly appreciated saying happy birthday to her. And that's the kind of thing that we really appreciate, seeing that our customers see the hard work that our men and women are doing throughout the day and night to get their power back on, and how we're all going to get through this together by helping each other out.
All right. Thank you so much. That was Bill Orlov with Florida Power and Light. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much.
And without power, many are without the ability to cook, and with limited fuel, fewer are able to run to the store or drive around looking for a restaurant that may happen to be open. And that's where Mercy Chef swoops into the rescue. It's a faith-based nonprofit with the mission of feeding people in crisis. A New Orleans native, Gary LeBlanc, founded the organization after he saw how poorly people's basic food needs were being met after Hurricane Katrina. I was able to talk with him this morning before they started lunch service at US 41 and Williams Road in Estero.
We got started yesterday, and yesterday we fed just over 5,200 meals. And always our first day is a little slower, but the word will get out. Today we're preparing to serve 7,500. And with this crew and this kitchen, we'll top out at about 10,000 meals a day.
That's going to be the max?
Yeah.
Are you getting some input from local farms and local chefs or anybody coming out to help?
We are. We've got a couple of chef friends here in the area that have been helping provide resources and connections for us. We have had a local free-range farm. They brought us eggs and beef yesterday.
Circle C. I know Nicole well.
Yeah, so she was here with a bunch of great stuff yesterday, and we expect her back. And then she's networking out among all her contacts and friends for us as well.
What are some of the needs that you have? I think that you've mentioned that there are people in communities that you can't get to or can't get here.
Right. Well, as always, we see that storms seem to affect those that really have the least resources the most. And obviously, there are a lot of folks around here with great resource, and they'll be able to rebuild pretty quickly. But we're finding little pockets of communities that are either migrant or undocumented or people just living in poverty. It's hard to believe in places like Bonita Springs, but there are always pockets of poverty. We've discovered folks even right behind the church that have absolutely no resources. I guess the bigger thing here too is when you have no power and no gas and no food, it's a great equalizer. Everybody pretty much is in the same circumstance. So it's been very unique to see the community bond together regardless of whatever else might divide them the rest of the year. And so it's been very impressive. The community down here is not only resilient, but they've been very compassionate one towards the other.
And have you had people wanting to volunteer? If people do want to volunteer, do you have space for people? I mean, I don't want to get too many cooks in the kitchen, but what do you need? Do you need people to transport some of these meals to some of these pockets?
Yes, that'd be helpful. We're working through the church here at Living Waters, and they're coordinating volunteers and food distribution for us. And it's nice to have a church partner because they know the community better than we do, and they know where those areas that need the greatest service would be. So to come in and connect with a local church has been a great advantage for us.
If people do want to come help, though, should they bring their car if they have a full tank of gas to come help deliver, or is somebody else coordinating that through the church?
That's through the church, okay. And I think we have enough distribution vehicles where we'll need help here on site are folks actually plating and serving and help clean up and keep the site working smoothly.
Gary says the menu today will be cucumber tomato salad, a baked penne pasta dish, and homemade sugar cookies, which smelled delicious. They're serving lunch and dinner in the parking lot of Living Waters Church at US 41 and Williams Road until they run out. And as people sort out their own conditions, there are many wanting to help out, but wondering where and how to direct their energies. Here with some ideas is Tracy Galloway, the CEO of the Community Cooperative of Southwest Florida, who's been making the rounds with their mobile food pantry this morning at the Lee County VA Health Care Center in Cape Coral, distributing food, water, and other supplies. Tracy, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So what kind of response have you gotten yet from the mobile food pantry this morning? What do people need now that we're squarely in the cleanup phase of this Hurricane Irma recovery?
Well, this morning at the VA, we obviously are serving a lot of veterans in the Cape Coral area, North Fort Myers area, who still have no power. Many of them have no water, and we're hearing that a lot of them are starting to have sewer backup issues. So the situation for them is not good. So we were out there to provide shelf-stable foods. We have breads. We have bananas. We had water. We've had our grills. So we were feeding them at the same time. And we will be out in Lehigh tomorrow afternoon at Veterans Park Academy of the Arts from noon to 2, and Saturday morning we'll be at North Fort Myers Community Park from 8 to 10 a.m. doing the same thing, providing folks with just basic shelf-stable grocery, water. Hopefully by Saturday we may have some ice. We can't promise it. We're really trying to get some ice for folks. And then we'll be cooking as well on our grills just to give them a little, you know, something warm to put in their belly, something nourishing that, you know, they probably haven't had now for a few days.
Yeah, anything warm is kind of nice to have something actually yeah. cooked. Do you need any kind of help? Are you looking for volunteers to help out, or are you looking for donations?
Yeah. Both. So at the same time we're doing our mobile food pantries, the soup kitchen down on Martin Luther King Boulevard, where our main offices are located, is open. And we are also delivering every day to about 350 Meals on Wheels clients who are elderly shut-ins who have no ability under normal circumstances to get out and do anything for themselves, and now especially are in dire need of support. And so we need as many hands as we can for assisting with mobile pantries tomorrow and Saturday to distribute the food, and then to be on site on our Martin Luther King Boulevard office to work in the kitchen and the cafe, because we've got a lot of food prep, we've got a lot of cooking to do. Plus, if anybody wants to come and help clean up our property, we had a lot of trees down and some modest damage to the property, like a lot of folks. So that's been last on our list, though, because we've been focusing on helping those in need before we worry about cleaning up our own yard.
So you already work with a lot of volunteers anyway. Are you having a hard time with some of your volunteers being unable to get there to do their normal volunteer work? Are they having a hard time getting there because of the lack of gas?
Yes, that's exactly what we're finding. So we have a lot of our normal folks. We have a lot of retirees who are kind of our daily normal volunteers. A lot of them evacuated, so some of them aren't back yet. We do have some really diehard volunteers. We had one lady who drove 25 hours took her to get from Atlanta to here because she knew she had to deliver her Meals on Wheels route yesterday, which I thought was very heartwarming.
That's some great dedication,
went
right?
Over and above. The dedication was so much, so impressive to me. But yeah, so, and then with Meals on Wheels, you know, it's a lot of folks who are driving their own cars. In certain areas, they can't get to the flooded areas and out east in Lehigh and down in Bonita area with a car. So we're trying to accommodate folks and put folks who have SUVs on certain delivery routes, and not trying to have them do too many routes because gas is scarce, and we know that that's a big issue for everybody. And that's the same with our own vehicles. We're trying to really manage the usage of our fleet because gas is scarce, and we don't want to get into the point where we can't drive and deliver food because we have no gas.
So if somebody does want to volunteer, they seem to have plenty of gas and they'd like to do a route or two, what do they do? Do they just show up down at your facility at a certain time?
So if they just want to help volunteer in the kitchen and do food prep and packaging the food and serving food in the soup kitchen, they can Monday through Friday, anytime from 7 a.m. to 1 o'clock p.m., we are working in the kitchen and doing all of that, and they can just show up this week and next week. And we're waiving on the application process because we need volunteers and don't have time to do the normal protocol of getting all their information. If they want to do Meals on Wheels delivery, we do have to schedule them. So we would just ask them to give a call. Probably the easiest right now, because phones and internet are sketchy, is to Facebook us if they have Facebook. At Community Cooperative is our Facebook handle, and they can private message us their phone number, and we can call them on ourselves.
Okay, and
that's
for people,
how we've been having good opportunity.
Social media has really helped a lot of people through a lot
of things.
It's
been very helpful.
Mm-hmm. And if somebody has donations they want to drop off, what kind of things could you use if somebody has extra laying around, or if they want to run to the store, and where do they drop it off?
We are, I'm going to give our address first, is 3429 Dr. Martin Luther King Boulevard. We are just just west of the Veronica Shoemaker intersection on Martin Luther King Boulevard. And we are there Monday through Saturday. They can drop off anytime. But we are most desperate need for water, cases of water. If folks have diapers, pull-ups, anything for children, that's a need. Basic needs, toilet paper, toothpaste, things that people can't get out of their house to get. And anything, if they've got anything for children, baby food, jarred baby food, formula, things like that, those are hard to come by. And people are forgetting that right now a lot of businesses are closed. So we've got a lot of folks who are hourly employees who are not getting paid right now. So their paycheck that's already thin is getting even thinner. And so it's just going to be more difficult for them in the coming weeks to make ends meet.
Yeah.
And so we're trying to do everything we can to help keep them going, because the next few weeks are going to get worse, because when their next paycheck's going to come, it's going to be smaller than normal.
Yeah, when it was supposed to be there.
And so even 2 weeks, 3 weeks from now is going to be a difficult process for these folks to get back on their feet.
And it's even tougher because that's about the time that people start turning on to different things and change the focus of their attention and maybe forget.
Exactly.
I know that in the future you have plans for assisting people with filing claims for FEMA. Can you tell me about that?
So it's actually a very simple process, although it can be a bit frustrating at times like this because everybody is going to be wanting to do it. But we just have a social services program division where we've got case coaches who are working with folks on a daily basis that help with walking them through processes and times like this is when we really try to reach out to everyone and just give them the right phone numbers, give them the right web addresses, offer them Wi-Fi at our facility, and so they can get on computers and get their files or their claims filed. And it's a very simple process, but you do have to you can't do it on the phone. You have to do it through the internet and do it online. So once libraries start to open and power comes back, we're encouraging them to do it sooner than later because obviously it's kind of first come, first serve basis. And the faster they can get in and get their claims filed, the better it'll be for them.
Yeah, and you'll let them know what kind of information they're going to have in order to do that because that would get frustrating
exactly.
If you don't have that.
It's very frustrating. That's the biggest thing is they're so stressed about what's happening with their homes that they, you know, it can be a frustrating process. In that regard. So we're helping walk them through those processes and just getting them to the right resources. You know, sometimes we're not the ones that can help them with their particular need, but we have access to the other agencies who can help them. And so a lot of what we do is just connect. You know, if we can't help them, we make sure we get them to the folks who can help them with whatever their particular need is.
All
and
right.
Especially in times like this, we have a very good network in our United Way network here in Lee County. And so we're all very good partners and are very very well connected to know that there's nobody that's going to fall through the cracks. If there is something that can be done, we will get them to the folks who can help them.
All right. I want to thank you, Tracy Galloway, the CEO of the Community Cooperative of Southwest Florida. Thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you.
Coming up on Gulf Coast Live, it's not just food, fuel, and water that's in short supply. South Florida's blood banks are running critically low. We'll talk with organizers of emergency blood donation drives in Sarasota and look at why the needs are so great after Irma. Plus, Collier County is trying to decide when to resume classes in some of the areas hardest hit by Irma. We'll talk with Superintendent Dr. Camilla Patton for an update. This is Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Stay with us. Welcome back to Gulf Coast Live. I'm Julie Glenn. Today on the show, we've talked about water, food, and power, three necessities in short supply that everyone affected by Hurricane Irma is working to secure. But another vital need in short supply in Southwest Florida after the hurricane is blood and blood products like platelets. The Suncoast Blood Bank and Sarasota Memorial Hospital are organizing an emergency blood drive to meet that critical need. And for more on these low supplies of blood and how they're working to meet them, we turn to Lori Lang, the COO of the hospital, as well as Lisa Collins Brown with the hospital's Emergency Care Center. Welcome to Gulf Coast Live.
Thank you.
Lori, you were working in the wake of Hurricane Irma. The blood bank supplies are critically low locally and statewide. Why are they so low at this time?
Well, a number of reasons. One is that there's a continuous need for blood for babies, for individuals with cancer, and for when you're doing cardiovascular surgery and for traumas. So those needs don't go away. But we have seen when people were preoccupied with pre-IRMA preparations, people were either leaving the areas, and or if they were typically routine donors, they were not doing that because either they weren't here or they were distracted with doing preparations for IRMA. So our supply went down and our demand stayed constant or actually went up.
Lisa Collins-Brown, what kind of needs for blood are you seeing with your patients right now, and what would cause the need to go up a little bit after this type of a thing?
Well, right now we're needing platelets as well as O negative and all other negative blood types. Platelets are really important for the clotting process. So like Lori was saying, we see those in the cancer patients. Also, we are a trauma center here at SMH, so we have seen some trauma. A lot of it is related to that hurricane preparation with people out doing more, putting up, you know, their shutters, also some motor vehicle accidents as the lights aren't working, those kind of things. But platelets are probably our biggest need right now.
Platelets are the big deal. And how do you obtain platelets? Is that a whole blood type of a donation that's different from regular donating of blood?
Well, they donate blood, but then the platelets are then separated from the blood with a centrifuge, and during that process it takes about 90 minutes, and then the blood components are retransfused back into the donor along with the additional fluid. It gives you increased energy, so to speak.
Oh, okay, so you don't end up having as much blood taken in order to get that amount of platelets.
Correct.
I understand what you're saying. So, Lori, where and when is this blood drive you're organizing in Sarasota?
So the blood drive is being held with one of our community partners, which is Michael's on East. It's a restaurant and a banquet facility. They have a ballroom. So they were able to accommodate a lot of individuals who want to donate. It is with Suncoast Blood Bank, and they are doing it on, the address is on Tamiami, right across from the hospital. It is from 11 to 6 today and from 9 to 6 o'clock tomorrow.
Okay, and if people are donating there, is that going to be staying there, or is that going to help replenish supply in other parts of the state as well?
So it will be we will be supporting the entire state.
Okay, so and do people just walk in?
Yes, and I have the address here. I'm sorry, it's 1212 South East Avenue, which is in Sarasota. It's right off of Tamiami and Bella Vista.
And you said it's across the street from the hospital?
Yes.
It's usually pretty easy to see the hospital.
Yeah.
if you can't find that. We didn't have a whole lot of injuries, though, and we mentioned that the need kind of goes up. But you're saying like small injuries, like people maybe clearing out brush or things out in front of their house may have obtained injuries that would require a need for blood?
Yeah, well, I think we always are using blood, like Lori said, through our OR cases and those kind of things, and we just haven't seen the donations that we generally see. Platelets are only good for 5 days, so we're always having to replenish those. So those are usually the first things that you end up having trouble with in terms of replenishing and keeping a good supply. So it's not only along with the trauma patients, it's open heart patients, it's any patient that would need any kind of blood products.
And are there any things that would disqualify people from donating, some of the misconceptions about donor eligibility?
Well, generally, women with multiple pregnancies are not good candidates, especially for platelet donation. But, men generally over the age of or over 150 pounds and those with AB universal donors, those are always good candidates. We like to see them coming in and donating as much as possible.
All right.
So
well,
what I would, if I could add to that, so they are in need of all blood, but specifically platelets.
Yeah.
So, and we can always use blood. Blood typically has, and blood products usually has a shelf life of more than 30 days. So we have been asked by many hospitals across the state, they're calling our blood bank to see if we can share. And yesterday we actually had to postpone a few open heart cases till today until we were able to get a few more platelets packs back into our blood bank. So it really is very serious.
That is really critical that you had to actually postpone some surgeries in order to wait until you had enough.
Yes.
Well, that'll make sense then that you're doing the emergency thing. And again, can you give me one more time the location where the emergency blood drive is?
It's at the restaurant and ballroom is called Michael's on East, and it's located at 1212 South East Avenue, which is in Sarasota, which is almost directly across from the hospital. On the cross streets are Tamiami and Bella Vista.
All right. And again, that's today from 11 a.m., which is passed, all the way till 6 p.m., and then again tomorrow from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Thank you so much for talking with us today, Lori Lang and with Sarasota Memorial and Lisa Collins-Brown with the Hospital's Emergency Care Center. I hope we helped get the word out.
We do, too. Thank you so much.
Another question on many parents' minds is, when will schools be back in session? In Lee County, the goal is to have schools open by Monday, but in Collier County, students may not return to school until midweek next week. Obviously, hit harder by Hurricane Irma has pushed that return date back. And here to talk to us more about the state of the district is Dr. Camilla Patton, the superintendent of Collier County Schools. Thanks for joining us today. Dr. Patton, are you there? I don't think we have Dr. Patton. It looks like we'll try to connect with her in just a little bit.
We have her.
Oh, we do have her.
Thank you. This is myself, Cam Patton.
Oh, hi. How are you?
How are you?
What is the current state of the district in Collier County?
So in Collier County, for us, in getting schools back up and going, it's all about power right now. So we're looking for 54 sites to have power currently. So right now we're still, as the hours tick by, we're having people call in. So we have only 19 of 54 sites that actually have power. We started today with 11. So over halfway through a day, we've gained 8 more schools back. So power is a big issue for us. So we were able to help our community. We have planned for only opening 10 shelters. And that need arose as the storm changed directions and came right to us. So within 30 hours, we went from 10 shelters to 29 shelters. So that's a record for us. That was 190% increase of opening shelters all within 30 hours. So we're very committed, obviously, here to get back to the classroom together. We certainly want to thank all of our administrators and then our volunteers, because a lot of people assume that the Red Cross opens shelters. So the Red Cross only opens shelters outside of the flood zone. So for us, 28 schools, we open those shelters, only one, the Red Cross. Now the Red Cross comes in to help afterwards. So I want to just thank so many people that made that happen, and just one story after another from our guests of how incredible staff and volunteers were to make their experience. So now we're to the point of that cleanup. So obviously we all saw that, fortunate not to have those drastic storms surges that, you know, we were very concerned with, the over 10 feet storm surges that would have just been a whole different story. So
sure.
That water damage really seemed to have been traded off with wind damage. So we're all about cleaning our schools. Right now, all of the other schools that were not used as shelters, they're cleaned, ready to go. However, we had water lines break that led to sanitation issues in shelters. We had pet shelters for the first time, so we need power to get the rest of that cleaned up. We still have 2 schools that we have sheltered actual people, special needs, and out in Immokalee High School. Regular guests also, and then we have 4 other buildings that are still used as shelter, because a lot of time people don't think, like, where does the National Guard stay when they come in to help, and law enforcement, and Florida Fish and Wildlife. So we're a host of many other different agencies. And then really it's our power. And the other one I'd want to mention is that we had 54 sites, 36 that had roof damages. So that is our second biggest priority, is to just be sure all those roofs are repaired. But, you know, Julie, we're just very thankful that in reality there's no catastrophic damage. There's no school missing an entire roof or sections of a whole roof, exposure of 15, 20 classrooms. So we're very grateful that we came out of this probably one step better than what we went into it. We are returning. Our aim is to return on Wednesday, September 20th. And then that's Wednesday for our students. And then on Tuesday, September 19th, aiming to have our teachers back with us. But again, the word aiming is that's all about the power.
It's all dependent on getting it. Yeah. So once you get that power back on, what happens next? I mean, say the lights turn on the 18th. Do you have to get in there and do a safety assessment, make sure that there aren't any ceiling tiles hanging down? Or have you been able to get in there and do that already.
So, right. So that kind of damage assessments we've had done. We know if there's missing ceiling tiles. So as we've explained to our principals, if your classroom happens to be missing 25 ceiling tiles, we're not stopping school for ceiling tiles. The only thing that would stop school is that power, the school's not being cleaned, which will get cleaned. And then obviously our other priority was making sure the debris is removed from all of our entrances for our buses and cars. So that will easily be done by then. So we're pretty good in those states. Again, it's just down to making sure that we have those roofs done, and then we have our power back on. And the good thing is on a daily basis from 8 to 10 in the morning, we get a continual every day, all 54 schools check in until we get the yes, yes, and yes. Yes, they have power, and yes, the debris is removed from that we can and can we open. So
are you
those
gonna,
are our three yeses.
Are you going to wait until all 54 schools are up and running before you start school back up, or is there any possibility of some students being shifted around if there's a school that can't come back in time?
Well, we're going to make that call as it gets a little bit closer because one of our few schools that we were concerned about is Everglades City down there.
They got some water.
Very isolated pocket. Right. So if we run into problems like that, we'll figure out how we can move from one to the other. We're just going to hope that that power is ready to go.
And we're also hearing a lot about Marco Island. How are the schools affected down in that area?
So surprisingly, our elementary school is in very good shape in Marco Island. We were very, very surprised, you know. So we do expect some changes. For instance, there's a Marco Island kinder through third grade Montessori school. So they already were in contact with our elementary school and just mentioned that their entire roof blew. So we have a team of our, as we do centralized registration, so we'll have two of our centralized registration staff down at that Tommy Barfield Elementary School in Marco Island to accommodate any of those parents, mm-hmm. that they could come right to Tommy Barfield to help that school out and until whatever they want to rebuild or help them out in any way. So we've been trying to stay in touch with anybody that can use our help with their private schools that might have had some trouble.
Yeah, and I wanted to ask also, is there any need that members of the community might be able to provide as the schools work towards getting back online? Is there any, I know people are kind of, that are doing okay, are wanting to help out someone. Is there any opportunities for volunteerism or any kind of assistance that the community could give to the schools?
Sure. So we have a contact, Jennifer Lanza, that works with our school district, and her phone number is 239-377-0151. And as soon as we have power in this building, the administrative center, she'll be back. We're hoping again that on Monday we'd be up and powered, that people could call to volunteer. And I think there's still, you know, some people that are transient, staying at other people's homes or staying at grandparents' homes and things. So, you know, I think donations, as far as kids are, any kind of brand new clothing, sneakers, any undergarments, anything like that, that same number is going to be our collection site as to where and how you can drop off any materials like that, because we do have a lot of kids that are staying at other people's homes. And, you know, we'll be working with our schools, too, to relax, like dress uniforms, you know, mm-hmm. to allow kids that may not have access or people that don't have power to do their weekly laundry.
Yeah, we all so just heard we're not supposed to do the laundry. Even if you do have water, we're still not supposed to do that laundry. We're going to keep that sewage down.
So we know those kind of things, so we're really working to take care of that. And then that emotional side, too, Julie, is that, you know, we've had a chance with our school district cabinet yesterday to really talk through pre, during, and post-storm what were, you know, the positives that happened, how can we improve for the future, what were best practices. We'll be meeting with our principals early on Monday and doing that same exercise, and then also then we have that ready to push out for our staff. And then our English language arts teachers, we have some questions that are all research-based about just a couple of questions to get kids to have an opportunity to talk about their experiences, because this is very traumatizing for a lot of the kids, you know, that stayed overnight in a school and it's not even their school. These are unusual things. But, you know, Julie, on the other side of this, too, is we've heard from a lot of our parents, which many of them are our staff members, too, that this storm has also allowed them to have family time that they have not had in the past without devices or anything. So they've cooked together, they've played board games together. together. They've really heard more about their school. And so, you know, I think that, you know, you always look at the positive things. So to hear so many people have gotten to spend quality time with their kids, always spending time, but just some really good devices, televisions off and everything, just really kind of reunite with their family. So
exactly.
We're happy for those kind of moments.
Exactly. I want to thank you so much, Dr. Camilla Patton, the superintendent of Collier County Schools. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Bye, Julie.
Bye-bye. Meanwhile, in Lee County, Superintendent Dr. Greg Adkins is scheduled to make a short statement and answer questions about the impacts of Hurricane Irma on schools in Lee County at 3 o'clock this afternoon. Florida's U.S. Senators Democrat Bill Nelson and Republican Marco Rubio have been traveling Florida this week to survey damage left in the wake of Hurricane Irma. The senators' visit to Ave Maria University in eastern Collier County Wednesday served as a bright spot on their tour. They sat down with a group of college students who bravely and selflessly chose to ride out the hurricane, helping residents of the nearby farmworker town of Immokalee. WGCU's John Davis was there and brings us the students' stories in their own words.
I'm Michelle Zettel, and I'm a senior here at Ave Maria.
I'm Rachel Lewandowski, and I'm also a senior here.
So basically, there were some people in Immokalee, and they were living in a nursing home there, and they were abandoned by their caregivers. So the police called our university and asked if we could take them in, and the university complied with that. And we were contacted, well, Rachel was actually contacted, and she contacted me and another nursing student, Andrea Bradburn. And we all went over and we assessed the situation with the elderly people. We looked at their medications, tried figuring out like what kinds of diseases they had and how we could best help them. And we figured out like if they could use stairs, if the power went out and we had to evacuate real quickly. And then through looking at the medications and seeing what was wrong with them, we like figured out that a lot of them needed their blood pressures to be taken, some needed their heart rate monitored. And basically, like if something went wrong, we taught the people that would be in the building during the storm what they could do in order to help them if something went wrong.
We were able to get everyone's diagnosis, and we looked at their meds, and we could see exactly what they needed help with, and it just went from there. So.
Actually, it was a great learning experience for us. Because going into clinical, we usually just deal with people of the same language and cultural background as us. So dealing with someone that doesn't speak hardly any English at all, and a few of them spoke no English, it was really a good learning experience for us, just to figure out what to do.
It was an amazing experience, and like something we don't get to see every day in the hospitals or any of the clinical rotations we have. It's the language barrier was the biggest language barrier we have ever experienced
by far.
Before.
I mean, yeah. I've dealt with Spanish-speaking patients before, and I've taken Spanish ever since kindergarten, so even though I'm not fluent, I can figure out the main idea of what they're trying to get across, but like Haitians, it was very difficult. We knew nothing. We were trying to Google even some words, and we were not finding anything.
Yeah.
So it was definitely a great learning experience, and I'm glad that we went through it now as students before we're actually in the working field.
Yeah. I was talking to my dad, deciding whether to leave and go to somewhere else that they thought was safer or stay here. And he put it in perspective, and he said that it was our job as medical students that if anything were to happen, then we could be here. It just goes to show, like,
we are learning.
Our teachers here are incredible and, like, teaching us so much. And you don't really think about it when you're in your classes because you're so absorbed in it. But, like, when you're out in the real world like this, you're seeing, like, you are learning, and that the teachers here at Ave are doing a great job with our nursing program, and really excited to be part of it.
I'm Jacinta Hogan. I had the privilege of spending a couple days during the storm in the field house where the residents from Immokalee were sheltering. So it's a gymnasium. I went in there initially to play with the kids, and the play date just didn't end, so I was in there for a couple days. And it was just a very amazing, humbling experience. I knew there was kids, and I love kids. I'm from Michigan. I miss my family. I've got a toddler for a baby sister, and I imagined if my family was stuck in there, they would want someone to distract their kids. They were definitely more scared than I was because they knew that their homes were still out there, and they also left their pets behind because they weren't allowed to bring them. So they were very concerned about their animals that they had left within the trailer. So it was really just distracting them. There'd be lots of loud noises, so I'd just turn the movies up louder, and we got through it. I heard from some of the people there that there are some families that did not come because they were afraid of being deported. So there was also tension very high in there because they knew that some of their friends were still back in the trailers, which are unstable in this type of storm. So that was very hard to hear. But I was blessed to be with the children, and I met a lot of great families and great people there. I'm told it was not prepared for this level of hurricane. It held up very well. It was a little scary because we didn't know that it would stay together, so the ceiling shook a lot. There was a hole in the roof at one point, and the doors blew open, so the police came and they actually handcuffed it shut. But everyone responded really well. What we didn't know is a tornado touchdown just outside the field house completely mangled the bleachers and the turf, and we were right next door. So I really do think our prayers to the Blessed Mother, they really worked, because that could have easily ripped through the building and it just went away. So there were times that it was scary, but we got through it, and I'm very blessed to have been in there. I just think that this hurricane really brought people together, and I'm very excited. As a freshman, I got to experience that. Obviously, there was a lot of chaos, a lot of fear, but people really united. Strangers that I didn't know were offering me food and water and blankets because they saw that I didn't have any. And they really watched out for me, and they watched out for each other. So I think that was really cool to see.
You know, obviously, we've seen a lot of hurt in the last 72 hours and a lot more to come. But I thought it was also important to count, you know, come out and really be uplifted by some of these stories. And, you know, young Americans, I hear people from time to time worry about the future and about young Americans, and I would just say today is an example of why I think we should be very excited about the future. I think these young men and women here are an example of that willingness to serve that really gives this generation the opportunity to be the next great generation.
That was Ave Maria senior nursing students Michelle Zettel and Rachel Lewandowski from Minnesota and also Virginia, respectively, along with Ave Maria freshman Jacinta Hogan of Michigan and Florida Senator Marco Rubio. Earlier in the show, we talked about Mercy Chefs, which is on 41 and Williams Road, but I wanted to mention a few other places where people can go and get food if they are in need. Here is a list of drive-up distribution locations where the National Guard will be handing out MREs, or Meals Ready to Eat, and water. In Bukelia, at Our Lady of Miracle Church on Stringfellow Road, in North Fort Myers, Prairie Pines Preserve on North Tamiami Trail. The Veterans Park Rec Center in Lehigh Acres is also a distribution point. Estero High School at Williams and River Ranch Road in Estero is another distribution point, as is the Naples-Fort Myers Greyhound Track in Bonita Springs on Bonita Beach Road in Bonita Springs. Villas and Elementary in Fort Myers. Flea Masters Flea Market also in Fort Myers. And Lehigh Acres Fire Station 1 in Lehigh. Also in Fort Myers, the Stars Complex on Edison Avenue, FEA Ministries on Nuna Avenue, and the Alliance for the Arts on McGregor Boulevard, as well as Shady Oaks Park on Marion Street, are points of distribution. The National Guard will also visit communities throughout the area to pass out food and water to those who are more isolated or unable to get to the distribution centers, and these distribution centers are open from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. Our show today was produced by Matthew Smith. Our director is Richard Chin Kui. Our social media coordinator is Tara Callaghan. Gulf Coast Live is made possible through the generous support of the Elizabeth B. McGraw Foundation. For now, thanks for listening. I'm Julie Glenn. This is WGCU-FM, Fort Myers, 90.1, WMKO Marco Island, 91.7 FM, NPR for Southwest Florida.